First, I'd like to apologize for almost knocking over two people in the parking lot. I don't know who it was, but I think I frightened them. You know, trust anybody who does that kind of thing to give you a share. I don't know. I was going to speak about this particularly mystical subject, the technical understanding of the 49 interactions that happen during these days. But first of all, it's technical, it's of more interest to the more philosophical. And secondly, there was a request to discuss a certain subject. And so since it was requested, let's try and look at that particular subject, and we'll try perhaps later come back to this more technical, mystical area. What was requested is plenty mystical enough, though, as you'll see. And that is the following subject.
There's a peculiarity that runs through the idea of the messianic idea. The concept of the Mashiach, that what we understand to be the messianic vision, we've discussed together in this forum some aspect of it, I recall. But there's a particular aspect of it that I don't think we've studied together. I think we began this discussion 2 years ago when I arrived here. I don't know if anybody's still here who wasn't here then. Let's look at that angle and take it as far as we can. And that aspect is as follows. I'll put it to you the way the question was put to me. And that's as follows. If you think about the messianic concept, you'll see that we're able to trace the pathway of the seed of Mashiach through history, right, until it disappears from history. That means we have pointers in Torah about where the idea of the Messiah crops up, indications where it crops up in history, and then we lose track of that thread, and we are promised that it will reappear at the end of history. But the problem is that if you follow the thread of where we do come into contact with the messianic seed, let's say, personality, those particular personalities in Torah who carry the seed, the genes, the physical seed of the Mashiach through history, you'll find an amazing paradox. And that is that the messianic figure is a figure of purity. He will be so pure that he will be able to redeem the world. We'll try and understand this more deeply. And yet you find his seed is transmitted by people who, and events and circumstances that seem so contaminated that it's very difficult to understand. I'm not sure if you're with me exactly, but we'll try and run through the together. Let's look at some of the aspects of this very amazing pathway, and you'll see it's very, very difficult to understand. And then if we get that far together, we'll try and understand the answer as much as we can. It's a very difficult answer. I'm not sure we can really answer it properly. But we'll have to understand some of why the messianic pathway is so problematic. Why such a pure soul has to come down through the world in such impure channels. You with me? That's the idea. Let's try and follow it together and see. Why I thought it appropriate to maybe talk about this a little bit now is because Nisan, this month, is the time when the messianic flower, as it's called, will flourish again. It says that the Nisan Nigalu, in Nisan, this month of Pesach, we were saved. Over Nisan Asid in the Higoel, that in this month we will be saved again. That means we know that the Mashiach will be born on Tisha B'Av, and that the redemption will occur again Pesach time. At least Nisan, at least this month. The month's not over yet. So we never give up hope. And it says that for that kind of thing, a person should hope, even if a sword is on his neck, right? Sword is descending on his neck, on its way down. Even when it touches his neck, he should still not give up hope. It's forbidden to do such a thing. And that applies to the messianic vision also. No matter how bad it seems or impossible, we never give up hope. And especially now, we actually have, if you want to know, we have a tradition that we don't give up hope even when it's impossible. And even if it wouldn't be Nisan, we would hope. There's a Hasidic story about a Hasidic Rebbe who was davening, praying that the Mashiach should come. The Hasidim saw him praying very, very intently, much longer than usual, on the Shabbos. One Shabbos, he was standing on his own, davening for the Mashiach. So
So the Hasidim said to him, but Rebbe, you know it says that the Mashiach can't come on Shabbos. And how can you daven for the Mashiach today, that he should come now? He was davening very intently that the Mashiach should come now. So the Hasidim said, you know it says quite clearly this. There's a whole detailed thing, Mashiach can't come on Shabbos. Eliyahu Novi, I think it says, could maybe come on a Friday, or even the Gemara says not even on a Friday, because people are too busy preparing for Shabbos. So he won't come on a Friday, the Mashiach won't come on Shabbos. It says quite clearly he won't come on Shabbos. So how come you're busy davening for him today? So the Rebbe turned to them and he said, let him come, so it'll be a kasha. So it'll be a problem. We'll have a problem. We'll ask him. We'll find an answer, but let him come first. Then we'll worry about it. There's a very Hasidic way of looking at things, but the depth of it is that that's exactly the nature of the Messianic path. The exact nature of the Messianic path is that it will be when it seems impossible. There's some aspects of this in terms of personal crisis and redemption we've discussed before together in this forum. Let's look at it from the national point of view. That's exactly the concept of the Messianic Advent, is that it will be dafka when it's impossible and completely unexpected. And when you'll be assured that it couldn't be now, that's when it'll happen. But on one condition, and that is that when you're convinced and assured that it couldn't be now, but you believe anyway that it will be now, when we do as a people, that's when it will happen. That means that what we'll be challenged to do is to believe and expect and know that the Mashiach could, right, that redemption could unfold itself now, when the now is a point that's impossible. Well, that means we'll be expected to hold to the impossible. That's what the Jewish people are supposed to be. That's what we always have been. We've lived through impossibility. And that's what will be expected of us. And the only way we can ever hope to get there, especially our generation, which is so hopelessly low and so hopelessly devoid of any emunah, even when it's easy, even when it's made easy for us and the people who want to teach us and who do know, it's hard enough for our generation. So to hold there at a point when there's no one around and when it's patently impossible is going to be very hard for our generation. But the only way that we can hope to get there is by being prepared. If we know that idea, as the mystics always say, if a woman doesn't know what to expect at the end of a pregnancy, if she goes through a pregnancy, if a woman doesn't know what to expect in a pregnancy, and she goes through the whole pregnancy thinking that each day will be a little bit more of what it was today, so then she'll be terribly unprepared for the experience of labor. But it's the experience of the labor at the end of a pregnancy that gives birth, even though it's radically out of proportion to the development that's happened up to that point. I'm not trying to put anybody off having children. But that's it. That's why if a woman's prepared for that experience, so then she can rejoice when the situation becomes more radical, more constricting, and looks more difficult, and looks dangerous, she can start to be happy, because she understands what that pathway is. That's what's expected of a Jew, is to be able to take what looks like adversity and understand that it's... There was a classic illustration of this in the last century when one of the great leaders, possibly the greatest Torah leader of his generation, halachic leader, of Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, one of the great, he was the Rav of Kovna, very, very great man. He was once asked a similar question. Similar thing happened to him to what I described with the Hasidim and the Rebbe davening. What happened once was that I think they say it was on Purim. Could be wrong about that. But the Balabatim, the people in his community, were challenging him and saying to him, they said to him the following thing. They said, Rabbi, you tell us that we are expected to believe that the Mashiach could come at any moment. Do you believe that? So he said, yes. So they said, do you believe that he could come now? So he said, definitely, he could come at any moment. So they said, but Rabbi, you know it says that the Messiah will not come while there is yet money in the pocket. That's the way they put it. There's an expression that does say, one of the predictions is, that while... It means there will be a particular kind of financial situation. The Gemara describes what it will be. There will be rampant inflation. There will be products, but inflation will be very... products available to buy, but inflation will be at an unprecedented level. And therefore, they said to him that there are still wealthy people around. And it says that only when there are poor people around... I don't understand what all these things mean, but let's just take it at face value. It says that while there are yet wealthy people, the Mashiach will not come. So how can you believe that he'll come now? Similar to what we... discussed before. How can you believe you'll come now since the conditions don't apply? So explain to them the following wonderful idea. Similar to what I mentioned before with the Hasidic Rebbe, but he explained it to them and he put it this way, and that's what we'll have to try and understand. He said this, that it's a remarkable thing to understand. What will happen will be unexpected. Not only unexpected, it'll be impossible. It'll be a revelation of the impossible. That's exactly what it will be. It will be a revelation of the impossible. Only once it's been revealed, it'll be obvious.
Once it's been revealed, you'll see that it had to be that way, and not only had to be that way, but all the indications, all the steps on the pathway leading to what happened now become apparent. You'll be able to see everything that constructed this situation. It'll be so obvious you won't understand how you could have seen differently. If you want a crude emotional analogy, it would be, let's just translate it, not into factual terms, but emotional terms, it would be like when a child, let's say, is very strictly disciplined by a parent. The child might not understand what's going on and might hate the parent at the time and might think it's completely unjustified and very, very negatively relate to that situation. When the child becomes of age and matures and understands that what was done was only out of love, and in fact it was that experience that brought them to be what they are now, that gave them their sense of discipline or structure, that in fact created what they really are, was the parent being able to give discipline, so then the child would actually rejoice now in what was a very painful experience before. Because that's how we understand when we go through, as a nation, we go through very bitter ordeals that Hashem chooses to give us, we understand that now we can't understand, or on an individual level, we understand that now we can't understand what's happening to us, but we have the emunah, the faith, to know that when it's over, we'll be able not just, we won't be happy that it's over, we'll be happy that it happened. Like it says in Pasuk, it says, Oidecha Hashem ki anaftabi, I will thank you, Hashem, because you made me suffer. That means it doesn't say, we'll thank you for delivering us. We'll do that also. But first, we'll thank you for making us suffer. Because only through making us suffer did you make us aware, capable, mature enough, etc., until you were able to. And you'll see that this principle answers many difficulties, such as the fact that we thank Hashem for taking us out of Egypt, right, for redeeming us from slavery. So many people ask, why thank Hashem when He put us in the first place? Why are you thanking Him for taking you out of slavery when He was the one who put us into slavery in the first place? But that's exactly what it means. We're thanking for the whole experience. We know that had we not been put into the fire, we wouldn't have been refined. You're not expected to understand. It's nice, frum talk at the moment, when we talk this way. It's nice, idealistic sort of talk. Don't think you're supposed to understand it emotionally. You're not supposed to understand. You can't understand it emotionally. The child cannot understand while he's being disciplined by the parent, but that it has a positive purpose. You can't understand, can't relate to that warmly. But he will later, when the thing is revealed. Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan gave them the illustration, beautiful illustration he gave them, was the fact that, and we have to hold on to this very, very tightly, and it's a precious thing to know, when the Jews were in Egypt, what we just went through now, the Pesach, reliving, the redemption happened after 210 years of slavery, you're aware of that. The problem is that there was a prediction that there would be 400 years in slavery. That's the problem. It was a Torah promise, no less than Hashem Himself promised Avraham Avinu that there would be 400 years in slavery. And actually after 210 years they were redeemed. So you figure that out. I mean, if Hashem Himself promised, He couldn't break a promise. So what's the understanding? The understanding is that He couldn't leave them any longer in slavery because they were so dangerously about to be lost that had He left them any longer, they would have been lost. So He changed the rules and He took them out. But that doesn't answer the question because He said 400. And He knew what He was talking. We're talking about Hashem, not somebody who miscalculated. He knew that it would only be 200 years. Why did He say 400? And how come He didn't keep His word? So Yitzchak Elchanan explained to them the following thing. It says in Chazal that the 400 years were calculated, that means, from the beginning of the slavery, they started counting. And after 210 years, they were redeemed. What happened is, the Chazal say this, that they miscalculated, they didn't know when to start the counting from. Actually, the counting should have been reckoned from the birth of Yitzchak. That means you didn't know when to start, and from then it was exactly 400 years. In other words, while you're in the situation, there's a premise that you're not aware of. So according to your premise, the thing's impossible. And you can't be aware of the correct premise now because you don't know how to look at things that way. That's a hidden pathway. What happens is, when the truth reveals itself, first what's revealed is an impossibility, and then you realize it's not impossible, that's exactly the way it should have been. When your eyes are opened, you realize that actually the calculation is perfect, just didn't know how to calculate. And we have that throughout Jewish history. In Purim, it says that Ahasuerus made a party because 70 years had gone by and the temple hadn't been rebuilt. And it was clearly stated that it would be 70 years of exile. So he made a party in rejoicing. What happened? Some years after that, the temple was rebuilt. What happened? He didn't know where to calculate from. Again, who says you start at the time you define as the year to start? So what it means is this. It's an amazing principle to know. What happens is impossible and looks wrong. But once it's revealed, then you understand that what was wrong was the way you were looking at it before. But you can't see that before. And you can't be clever before the fact. It cannot be that way. Now, with regard to Mashiach, let's try and understand this pathway.
what is the practical outcome of what we're discussing this evening is emunah. What we're supposed to have is there's a Jewish obligation to know this fact. We're not discussing much of the mystical wisdom we learn together is because it's Torah. And so we learn the mystical level because we have an obligation to learn Torah, even though you may not be able to go out and apply it in your daily life tomorrow. This is something that you definitely can. On Sunday nights, when we meet here, we try and apply everything that we learn, for those who come on Sunday nights, into practical reality, and we try and thrash out issues that relate very practically to everyday situations, as well as looking at the background. But tonight, on Monday nights, we try usually to look at the root of things. This is a subject that, while we're dealing in the root, has a practical outcome. The practical outcome is what a Jew should believe at Purim, Pesach, an experience that we just went through as a Jewish people when we were threatened in a very severe way and redeemed in a strange way that we don't understand exactly. What we're supposed to believe about that kind of ordeal and redemption. That's what we're trying to come out with this evening. Let's state the principle and then let's try and track it down. The principle is this, that the advent of Mashiach will be so unexpected that it couldn't possibly be predicted. That's the principle. You'll see it expressed in many ways. Classically, you see in English you lose this, but if anyone's familiar with the davening or any way that we express these things in Hebrew, you'll see that it comes through all the time. For example, we always refer to the Mashiach as a plant. It's a remarkable thing. Tzemach. The word that we associate with the messianic figure is Tzemach. Tzemach means a plant. Tzemach in Hebrew means to flourish or break, instead of break through the ground like a plant does. It unfolds like a flower, like a plant. Tzemach. We say Tzemach David Avdi, Matzmiach Keren Yeshua. We always talk in a language of causing the messianic revelation to flourish like a plant. So the mystics explain something like this. The unique feature of the flourishing of a plant from a seed is that it's the essential illustration in the creation of something that's unexpected. Because the way a seed bursts forth into a plant is that the seed first falls into the... If you think about it, it's amazing. The seed first detaches itself from the tree or from the plant, which looks like it's dying. Cannot receive sustenance anymore. It falls onto the ground, completely separate and alone, cut off from its source of nutrition, and then it sinks into the ground. And if you watch the seed, you'll see that it disintegrates. If you watch a seed, first of all, if you cut the seed open, you won't see any little plant inside. You won't find a small tree that's just going to get bigger. You don't see that. So even if you examine it, even if you take it apart, you won't find any indication of what it's going to be. Just a shapeless mess inside that seed. But what then happens is it starts to disintegrate, which looks even worse. And when it looks like it's about to completely disintegrate, so then a shoot comes out as if from nowhere, and that begins to grow. That's also what the springtime means, the mystics say. The winter is when the ground is hard, and just as the spring begins, so then the shoots break through the ground and you see something growing. The Gemara in Sanhedrin illustrates this principle from the biological world, from the animal world, by explaining, giving the example of a creature, I don't know what we'd call it in English, some sort of a worm or caterpillar, which is an animal that defines a pathway in life that looks like one thing and then suddenly becomes another. That's a worm that is very lowly, it's dull, not brightly coloured, it's blind, it creeps along the ground, it's like a proverbial lowly creature, a slug. And then what happens is, when it dies, it spins a cocoon. Before it dies, it spins some sort of cocoon, it creeps into the cocoon and it literally disintegrates. If you look at the pupa, if you look at the, whatever they call it, the pupa, the larval stage inside a cocoon, it doesn't look like a worm anymore. It certainly doesn't look like anything. It looks like a gelatinous liquid mass. And when it's reached that stage of disintegration, the cocoon splits open and a butterfly bursts out, which is the exact opposite. If there's a symbol, it's a remarkable thing. If you wanted to find a poetic symbol of something that was lowly, you'd find some kind of a worm. And if you wanted a poetic symbol of something that's light and bright and colored and floats in the breeze and all, I'm not much of a poet, but that sort of, then you'd probably choose some ephemeral, diaphanous creature like a butterfly, because it's light and it floats and it flies, which is a remarkable thing, as we've remarked in this context before. Anybody who thinks that happened by a few million years of accident, they're really, as we said before, probably such an individual probably did happen by accident. But you need your head read if you think that thought, I would say. That thought could have happened by accident. Because if you have to work out a mechanism of survival for a worm, that the last thing you would come up with, if you were an engineer, if you were looking for a simple, direct solution of how a worm could reproduce itself, you are the very, very distant solutions to come up with a genetic mechanism that makes a worm become a butterfly in order to lay eggs that worms come out of again. It's a remarkable thing. The Gemara brings it as an illustration in the creation of what will be actually what the Gemara is talking about there is the next world. Because the resurrection is an unexpected event that takes place when what you see is disintegration. You see a person live in the world, and then you see their life come to an end, and if you would see what happens beyond that, you would again see disintegration. But the message you get from these illustrations in the creation is that that's not the time to give up hope. On the contrary, if you have a mystical insight, if you have spiritual wisdom, you know that that's the time that a person actually spiritually and secretly could be happy, because that's what's going to bring about another life on the other side. The fact that you don't see it right now doesn't put us off at all. When you see a worm disintegrate, you certainly don't see a butterfly, and yet it happens. Now, that's the concept. The messianic revelation will be that. It will be after the disintegration looks complete. Then you'll see that flourishing, that sort of flower, bursting forth from the ground, or from the impossible, from what looks like ashes and ruins. By the way, a number of people have asked in these sessions, or afterwards, have asked me personally, how it's possible that we could merit such a revelation since we're such a lowly generation. We're so low, we have so little merit compared to previous generations who really struggled for Judaism and really gave everything they had, gave their lives literally in torture for Jewish values. And we're so lowly, we can hardly cope with being normal. We can hardly keep a normal family, we can hardly cope with anything normal these days. How are we going to merit such an intense light? But after what we've said in this short introduction, it should be obvious that that's exactly what it's going to be. It's going to be the least likely time. It will be the disintegrated generation of Jewish history. It will be the lowliest generation on earth. That will be the ground, the ashes, out of which will flourish the Messianic revelation. In fact, the Gemara says it will happen to a generation that's completely unworthy. Or completely worthy, or completely unworthy. Both are true. That's another subject. Now, let's try and feel out in practical terms how impossible this thing is. And then you'll see exactly what we're talking about. The seed of the Messianic pathway in history, you'll see, not only is hidden so that it will flourish in the end, but where it is revealed, it's impossible. When you see the purity, the light, the messianic light, spark, just a spark of it in history, you'll see it takes place, it sparks in a darkness that's so great, there's no way to understand how a light like that could be in such a dark place. It comes to the fore in such contaminated, such spiritually negative people, and at least who appear that way, and circumstances that the mystics have to explain how such a pure messianic personality, the genealogy, the generations of the Mashiach, could be in such negative places. Let's try and feel that out again, we'll understand. One thing you should understand from this pathway, in addition to what we mentioned up to now, is that, you see, there's so many threads, it's very hard to state each one explicitly all the time. I'm trying to mention them, and you must try and follow them through. We must try and remember them as we go along. You'll see that the situations are so unpredictable and they're so opposite to what you would expect that one of the consequences is that there's no way you can trace it. Because when the thing is always unpredictable, there's no way you can know where it's going to crop up again. For example, let me make it clear. Let's say you would want to trace the people who bear the seed of the Mashiach. Now, which great Jewish leaders in each generation are the ones who will, which man and woman in any particular given generation of Jewish history, is the one who is going to have a child who will be the forefather, the great-great-great-grandfather of the Mashiach. How would you look? You would look for those of greatness. Surely it's a person who will be great. You look for those of greatness. It will be a person of incredible spiritual purity. You look for those of purity, because a seed always, the plant always grows the way the parent plant was. A seed of a tree will always look like the same tree. Can't look different. Yet you'll see that when you find where the seed of Mashiach actually is born in history, it's from the lowest circumstances, not from the highest. And therefore, and it's so unpredictable and variable, that there's no way you can identify where it's going to happen. So one of the consequences of this is that, let's give a practical example. The date of the coming of Mashiach. You know, there are many attempts to try and predict what that date will be. Where from? From mystical interpretation of certain verses. Now, for example, in Daniel, the book of Daniel is a classic source. There's actually a verse there which relates explicitly exactly says when the Mashiach is going to come. The question is, how exactly to understand that, how to put the numbers together, is a problem. And we have a tradition that you'll never get it right. And you're not allowed to. Every other detail of the world's history is contained in Torah, but the date of the coming of Mashiach is not contained. Let's put it this way, it is contained. But it's contained in such a hidden way that you can never extract it. And that's why there have been many predictions by very great people of which date the Mashiach would come. And he never came on those dates. We've passed all those dates. The question is, if it was forbidden, why did they do it? The answer is, they weren't telling you the date when Mashiach would come. What they meant was, they were auspicious times. Those were times when the forces coincided in such a way that had we merited it, we could have brought him about. But nobody of any Torah knowledge ever thought he could actually say when it's going to happen, because it always remains hidden. The depth of this idea is that one of the ways of predicting something in the future is by reading the present correctly. One of the depths, there is another depth called prophecy, Nevuah, but I'm not talking about that now. One of the ways of knowing when a thing will happen is by correctly reading the processes and themes that are taking place now. Because if you're expert enough at understanding what's happening now, you can project them into the future and see what will be. Any professional, any expert in his field who's called upon to make certain predictions, let's say an economist, who has to tell you what things will look like in a week's time, what hope does he have of doing that? Simply because he knows how to understand what's happening now. Usually wrong anyway. But I mean, the whole idea is that he knows how to read what's happening now. Or in, let's say, my own field, let's say a doctor, who would have to tell you what this patient will look like in a week's time. And he can have a certain degree of accuracy. Usually wrong also. But he can have, why? Because he's seen this pathway before, and he understands the forces that you can't understand. You're not in touch with what's going on, even now. You wouldn't even pick up the signs. But a professional can pick up the signs. And therefore, he can put them together and see where they intersect. With a Mashiach, you can never do that. Because you can't get a hold, because the forces and themes and lines of force are buried right now. They're disintegrating under the ground. And therefore, nobody can tell you when it's going to come. Because first of all, we're not privileged to have that information through prophecy. And to feel out, to read the themes and the signs, we can't do. Because the one thing that's been buried deep in history is that. And therefore, there's no way. You see this thing, apart from the examples I gave you, you see it all the way through the creation. Do you know that medical science still does not know what triggers labor? In a pregnancy, right, we don't know what initiates labor. No matter how carefully you watch a woman, there's no test that's yet been devised. No hormonal or other biochemical or any other test yet devised that can say tomorrow this woman will be in labor. Because we don't, I'm not saying it couldn't be discovered, but it's a pathway that as you predict one day from the day before, you'll be accurate. But that final day, you won't be able to predict until it happens. And that's the way it will be. Let's just finalize this idea before we actually look at the practical examples with this idea. We learn this from the following source, and I believe we have mentioned this idea together. And that is where the beginning of the Messianic revelation was when Jacob, Yaakov, tried to tell his sons what the world would look like in the final revelation. So they gathered around him as he lay on his deathbed, and it says that he tried, Bikesh Legalois Lamasakats. He wanted to reveal to them the end of time. He wanted to reveal to them the date, let's say the date, but it means more than that. It means, it's a big misunderstanding to think that predicting the coming of the Mashiach means being able to put your finger on a page in the calendar. It doesn't mean that. It means to be able to show the pathway. That's what it really means. No one's interested. It's not really the superficiality of putting your finger on a date. What's meant is being able to understand the pathway. He wanted to show them the pathway. Imagine what a gift that would have been. It means in any agony that a Jew is going through, or a Jewish generation in the history of the world is going through, they would be able to look to how this is developing the Messianic revelation. It would be a tremendous source of encouragement and strength to us. If a person could see in any crisis or ordeal what it's doing for him, and he could really feel that and appreciate it, so then he would have a tremendous encouragement. Of course, it would be very painful also, because if you saw that it wasn't to be for a long time, then you'd get very desperate also, because you'd know that you'd have to suffer still for a long time. And therefore, it's a chesed that we aren't told how long an ordeal will last. Works both ways. So the sons gathered around the bed, all 12 of his gigantic, enormous, spiritually gigantic sons, and he tried to reveal to them the Messianic revelation. And as he tried to say it, it was taken away from him. His prophetic insight that was shining brightly, and he was able to perceive many things about the world. He looked at each son, and he was able to perceive what each son was as a personality, right, in a prophetic way. as he tried to reveal what they would all achieve together and where it would all come to fruition, was taken away from him. So he had a very negative reaction. He thought that maybe there was something wrong with one of his sons, who didn't merit to hear it, but as he perceived each of them, he saw that they were perfect. Each of them had reached a spiritual stature that made it not correct to assume that he was the cause of being unable to reveal this information. So then he understood that the problem must be that they're not united. If each one is perfect, and yet he still wasn't able to say it, it must be that each one is perfect, but they don't form a unit. And of course, from this you learn a very amazing secret, which is that we'll never have a messianic revelation until we're all completely united. And even if each of us achieves perfection as an individual, in case you think that's tough, but even if each of us could achieve absolute, total self-control and perfection spiritually, that wouldn't bring us close to bringing about the messianic revelation until we so connect with each other's perfection that we actually form one thing. Now, you see that from this example. But as he had that thought, the sons read his mind. They knew too. They also knew what the problem was. It wasn't difficult to figure out. So they said to him, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, which the Mefarshim say means, Shema Yisrael, listen, hear, O Israel, meaning Yaakov, that was his name, Israel. Just as Hashem is one in your heart, he's one in ours, which means the unity is. And then he relaxed, and he said, Baruch Hashem Kaved Malchus Olam Vayed, because he realized that the reason that it had been taken away from him was a special divine act. You hear that? It means that the normal pathway was that he was to have known it. But Hashem stepped into history, stepped into his mind. It means Hashem stepped into his prophetic pathway, and he ripped out of Yaakov's mind the revelation of what the end would look like. A remarkable thing, and he was unable to say it. And that put into history the idea that from then on it would always be a blank. No matter how much detail in Torah would always be filled in, the final messianic revelation will always be a blank. That's the source of it. Now let's look together at the specific question that was asked and try and understand how blank and how black it looks. When you trace the messianic path, let's look at some of the personalities, some of the fathers and mothers, and that means some of the physical human beings who gave birth to a child, who would later give birth to a child, etc., who would become the Mashiach. You'll find the most remarkable thing. We won't be able to go through every generation, or those that are revealed to us, but let's choose a few examples which should suffice to illustrate the point. The Midrash starts like this. It says that Hashem, as it were, Hashem is speaking. He says, I found myself a Mashiach. Right? Matsasi es David Avdi. I found David my servant. David is always the messianic, the name of Mashiach. It says that David will be the Mashiach. Right? Whatever that means. I mean, it says in the mystical writings, the Midrashic writings, that Adam Arishon, was destined to live for 1,000 years. Actually, he was destined to live forever. But after the sin, he had 1,000 years left to his name, to his credit. And he gave 70 of them to a man called David. He only lived 930 years. He gave 70 to David HaMelech, which means that that name, David, was already gifted with a lifespan that the first man on earth had actually given him. If you think about it more deeply, it actually compounds the problem, because it means that David actually lives on borrowed time. It means even the time that he spends in the world actually isn't real. It actually isn't time that belongs in the world. It's a gift that the primal man gave him. Actually of his own being, but actually doesn't have his own claim on it himself. He doesn't have anything of his own. Messianic revelation actually is the totality of what we put in. It's the totality of our own perfected egos will actually contribute and combine again to that perfection, which is actually what he'll be. Us and Hashem together. So it says like this in the Midrash. Matsasi es David Avdi. Amazing thing. I found David my servant. V'heichan mitzasiv. And where did I find him? In Sodom. In Sodom. You have to understand this. It means, when Hashem wants to explain to us where he looked for the seed, where did he find the seed of his Mashiach? Who was the great, 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 great grandfather of the Mashiach? He was a man living in Sodom. In Sodom. Sodom was a place, Sodom, of the most intense immorality. It was so intense. You hear the problem. We're finding the seed of the Mashiach not in some special, beautiful, mystical place of worship. We find him languishing in a place of such intense spiritual contamination that Hashem had to wipe it out. He had a special act to wipe out the town, not because it was so evil. In that place is where Hashem chose to find the seed of his Mashiach. Where you'll see that each stage that we discuss, it gets worse. Right? The problem gets deeper, you'll see. It doesn't get better. It gets worse. Where did I find him? In Sodom, in a man called Lot. Lot, nephew of Abraham, Lot. You know the word Lot means a curse, you know that? Lot in Aramaic, that root actually means a curse. The mystics say it's the opposite of Tal. Tal means dew, the dew of the resurrection, right? Spiritual power, the opposite, light means a curse, exactly the opposite force. Right? He was a man who in certain ways failed. He was a very great man. He had enormous spiritual power. He was prepared to give his life for his values. He went to live in Sodom, not because he wanted to be immoral. He went to live there to teach people how to live correctly. But nevertheless, he lived in a place that was so evil that certain perversions even are named after it today. And it was wiped out by a divine act of destruction. Where did I find him in Sodom, in Lot? In the following scene, the Midrash describes the most amazing thing. Chazal, the commentaries, explain. Where was he? He was in a man called Lot. That means buried in the body, not in the anatomy, in the physiology of this man, was a substance that would come out from him as a child. That means a piece of his own being, of his genes, of his neshama, was in stone. What was it doing there? It was giving a meal to two angels, right? Lot, you know, he received the two angels and he fed them a meal. Remarkable thing about that meal, I remember we discussed this 2 years ago, I'll just mention it again briefly because it's so beautiful to know. The remarkable thing about that meal is that, do you know what they were eating at that meal? Matzah. It was a Pesach Seder. It was a Pesach Seder. We know it from many sources. We know that those two angels had just visited Avraham Avinu and he gave them matzah. How you could have matzah and Pesach before there was a going out of Egypt, we're not going to discuss now. But it was the time of year when Pesach, the spiritual force of Pesach, was operating. And what he sat them down to at the risk of his life, because the crowd outside wanted to kill him. The place was so evil that they tried to kill anyone who showed hospitality to strangers. In fact, it says in Midrash that he had already sacrificed a daughter of his. The people, Lot had a daughter, whom he trained in true Torah values, to provide for people who don't have. And she had given something to a poor person who didn't have. And since it went against the principles of stone, they tied her down to the roof, smeared her with honey, and let the bee sting her to death. You know, that's what had happened. So Lot was living in the town. He was a man great enough to have sacrificed a child for his values. And obviously he imbued a child with enough spiritual conviction to be able to be prepared to give a life for such a thing. This man was sitting, feeding two men, a Pesach Seder. But the remarkable thing about that Pesach Seder is, the word that's used to describe it is Mishteh. Mishteh means a feast. But the remarkable thing about that is, there's only one other context in which Mishteh is used in Talmudic literature, and that's for a Purim feast. Which means that they were having a combination of a Pesach Seder and a Purim Suda. They were eating a Suda of Purim and a Seder of Pesach all at once. And of course the meaning of that is not hard for us to understand, and that is that they are both celebrations of a Messianic redemption. Purim is the time when the Jews were saved in the hidden way, in darkness, without recognition of Hashem's acts directly, and Pesach is the time when they were saved, yes, recognizing Hashem's act directly. So both of those forces, both of those lines in history crossed. What we're going to see is that when the seed of Mashiach raises its head, the lines of force in history cross. But only just briefly enough to be amazed, for you to be amazed, for us to be amazed at how unlikely it is, and then it descends and disappears again in history in some way that we can't follow it anymore. Remarkable thing, it was sitting amongst us this evening. Might be you. Somewhere in your genes, somewhere deep in your genes, might be the seed of Mashiach. Don't think it's unlikely. It's specifically because it's unlikely, it may be. Only if you think it's possible that he's in you, then definitely you're wrong. But if you think it's unlikely, then it's very possible. That's why we have to think about it. So what happened? In that unlikely, bizarre situation, on the eve of destruction, the next morning, the angels, the Malachim, had to rush him out of stone before they turned the place upside down and burnt all its inhabitants with the divine fire. At that moment, on the eve of destruction, about to be destroyed, had he hesitated a moment longer, and had he remained in stone a moment longer, he would have been finished, would have been destroyed. Just before they whisked him out, the seed of Mashiach appeared. There it was, sitting in this unlikely individual, in this unlikely place.
What happened from there? So it says in Chazal that the problem, as I said before, gets much more difficult to understand, not better. Because the people who were saved from that inferno were Lot and his daughters, as you, I'm sure you remember the story. Lot and two of his daughters were saved. They ended up in a cave. I'm sure you all know the story. Gemara in Nazir talks about it. They ended up in a cave, and the girls were convinced that they were the last people on earth. The two daughters were convinced that there were no other people alive, and that they were the last human beings ever to be present on the face of the earth. That they had just seen all they knew of the world destroyed, that they had seen the whole cities of the valley where habitation was destroyed, and they didn't know that anyone else had survived. They thought that the last man on earth was their father, and that they were the two last women on earth. So they decided that the only way to keep the human species going was to have a relationship with their father and bring children into the world from him. Now, they knew that it was forbidden. An incestuous relationship like that is a lucky problem, in that they weren't Jewish yet, the way we understand it, and therefore, and the whole incestuous thing has to be understood. There's a whole halachic debate about it. I'm not going to go into that now, but nevertheless, it was sinful. And we have a principle that you can't achieve the right end through the wrong means. Right? We have a principle in Judaism like that. We have a very deep principle. Yeah, confusing it becomes. Imagine the plight of those girls. You may be sure that they weren't in it. They had no vested interest in it. They had no, let's say, licentious or sensuous interest in this relationship. You can imagine that it must have been a negative experience. They were brought up, they were girls brought up in a home of such intense purity and self-sacrifice that they'd witnessed their father risk his life for his values, and they'd lost a sister, right, who'd given her life for her values. You can be sure they were very great idealists. To have to do this with their father was a very degrading experience, it must have been. But they did it out of an idealistic conviction that if they didn't do this, there would be no people on earth. But now, there's a big problem with it, because we have a principle that you can't do what's wrong for the right reason. We have a principle that if you're ever forced into a situation, I don't want to go into the halachic background here, but just briefly, we know that if you're ever forced into a halachic situation where you have to do something that's right, but the only way you can do it is wrong, so then you can't do it. Be very careful here. Be very careful. Here, this requires a whole discussion in its own right. There are times when what seems to be wrong is not wrong at all. For example, if you have to save a life, and the only way you can save the life is, let's say, by stealing. Well, of course you're allowed to do that, because stealing is not wrong in that situation. We're not talking about that. That's not called wrong. Are you with me? If you come across somebody in a diabetic coma on the street, okay, it's late at night, there's no one to help you, and the person's about to die, but right next to you is a pharmacy that's closed. So are you allowed to smash the window and go inside and get some insulin and save this person's life? Of course you are. That's not wrong at all. Of course you've got to pay afterwards. The next morning you've got to pay him. Nobody said you can do it for free. You owe him for the insulin and the window. But right now, I'm not talking about that. That's not called wrong. I'm talking about when the thing actually is wrong. To have an incestuous relationship for an outcome that's wrong, and it remains wrong. And we have a principle in Torah that if the wrong means have to be used for the right end, you're not allowed to do it. Right? What's our attitude to such a situation? We say to Hashem, it's your problem. You're the one who generates all situations. You put me in this situation where the only way I can do what you want is by doing something that you tell me I'm not allowed to do. So you take care of it, Hashem. That's what a Jew's supposed to say. You're not supposed to run his world for him. He knows what he's doing. So can you imagine these girls? But, there are three categories, three things in Torah, and I'm only going to mention one of them now, where there's actually a mitzvah to do what's wrong. Before anybody gets carried away. But it's called, one of these three is called Avera Lishma. And Avera Lishma, it means a sin for Hashem's sake. And the Gemara in Nazir that discusses this event of these girls having a relationship with their father says the following comment. Gedoyla Avera Lishma, Yose Mimitzvah Shelo Lishma. Listen to this. It is greater to do a sin for Hashem's sake. Of course, we're talking about one of these that's allowed, that he wants. Not a sin that you think would be nice right now to do something that you think is positive. It has to fit all halachic, all the ramifications. Yeah? But if it fits the definition correctly, the Gemara says, it is greater to do a sin for the right reason than a mitzvah for the wrong reason. You hear that? A mitzvah for the wrong reason, that means a mitzvah for your own vested interest, which is certainly allowed, is not as great as a downright transgression of sin that you do for Hashem's sake. But again, be warned, only those categories, that fit into this. What takes it out of this category? Most things. One that's classic is if it feels good in any way, if there's any vested interest, immediately it doesn't count. And a classic example of that, I'm not going to sidetrack for more than just a minute to share it with you because you don't understand the subject fully without it, is a classic case of Yael. Are you aware of that? There was a woman called Yael who had an intimate relationship with an enemy of the Jews because if she had not done it, she wouldn't have been able to kill him. She, if you read in the book of Devorah, you read between the lines carefully, it's very obvious what happened there. The words don't say it. The words say that she gave him milk to drink and he fell down and fell asleep. It's a very parrot, the way it's put up, very Milchic over there. But if you look in the song of Devorah, who praised Yael for doing what she did, it becomes very graphic and very obvious what happened. I'm a bit squeamish to go into the details. It's much more intense than you can even imagine. I can't bring myself to do it. Yeah? Check it out yourself. Look in the commentaries. But what happened there was very far from Parav. And when he was exhausted, it says, she drove a tent peg through his head and into the ground, which she never would have been able to do otherwise. So the Gemara says that was an Avera Lishma. She saved the Jewish people by doing this act. So the Gemara, so Reb Chaim Shmulevitz asks, but I thought there was a principle that if it feels good in any way, if there's any pleasure in it, it's not allowed. The Gemara answers she felt no pleasure. For a woman to go through such an embarrassing and degrading situation, a woman of her virtue, to go through such a terrible situation, which had the threat of making her forbidden to her husband afterwards, and all sorts of negative elements to it, that's not called a vested interest at all. That's called terrible suffering. But you have to be very, very great to be on a level where you're able not to have any vested interest in something that naturally does. So now let's just put ourselves in the dilemma of those two girls. There they were in a cave. Night was falling. Their father was with them. They felt they were the last two people alive, and they knew that on the one hand, this is a sin. It's an avera. On the other hand, maybe it's an avera lishma. One of the most difficult halachic decisions, and there was no poisek to ask. You didn't phone up anyone. You didn't phone up Rav Abba. You couldn't phone him up. There was no one to phone and no one to ask. And to make a decision themselves, a life and death decision, life and death of the world. Reb Chaim used to say that the whole Torah is easy except those three things. The Torah is easy. He never had a problem with anything in Torah. The only thing that's hard is when you have to do a sin for the right reason. That's hard to figure it out. And those girls had to do it. What did they do? You see what Hashem is doing with the seed of his Mashiach? He's putting him into the most questionable situations imaginable. What happened? They decided that they had to have a relationship with their father, intimate relationship, become pregnant from him, and that would be a birth of children in the world, and out of that, the world would have continuity. The Gemara says that the older girl went first. The first night they made him drunk. She was first in this mitzvah of Aaron Ishmael, and it says that she became pregnant, and it says that she named the child. Gemara even criticizes the way she had the shamelessness to name the child after the event, because she called him Moav. Moav means May Av, from my father, which means she even named the child a name of what had happened. It's not so simple. You could look at it as an act of greatness if she really thought it was an Avera Lishma. So then, Adarabah, she was doing something right. Very complicated. The second daughter didn't call the child by that name. She called him Ammon, and two great nations were born out of those children. Now, of the two nations that were born from those children, from the older one, Moab, was born a woman called Ruth, and Ruth was the great-grandmother of King David, who's the father of the Mashiach. So, let's understand what's happening. Here's this man called Lot, who's problematic. He ends up in a relationship with a daughter, which is extremely problematic. But there's a real seamy side of history, sordid element in history, that we would squirm at and try and avoid. It's there that the seed of Mashiach is being propagated and a child is being born who's carrying the seed of Mashiach. It's a remarkable... By the way, I want to point out to you, without being sectarian or biased in any way, there's no other religion on earth that talks this way about its great people. There are other religions on earth that will tear you apart if you talk this way about their great people. People have been subjected to torture for less than that, right? Because their tradition is one of sublime perfection. But Judaism explicitly talks about its greatest son, the Mashiach who will redeem the world. Explicitly describes this painful and sordid story one step after another. It's a remarkable thing. To my mind, it's a proof of the truth of Torah, you know, on its own. But I'll leave that up to you. So what happened? A child was born. Out of that child was born a woman called Ruth, Moab. Ruth was a woman from a nation so negative, Moab, that they had this stigma going back to this incestuous relationship, so bad that they were not even allowed to convert to Judaism. In fact, the problem with Ruth, the story doesn't get better, again it gets worse. The problem with Ruth was that her conversion wasn't recognized. There are many people of her generation and the next who refused to recognize her conversion because she came from such a lowly people, from a people who weren't allowed to convert to Judaism. And so her status as a Jew was tremendously problematic. But let's come to Ruth in a moment. Let's first look at something else. Ruth married a man called Boaz. Who was the forefather of Boaz? It wasn't only on Ruth's side that there was a problem. She married Boaz. 8 generations before Boaz, that means his father's father, etc., 8 times, was a man called Yehuda. He was a descendant of Yehuda. Yehuda and Tamar had a child, right? Who had Boaz. And Boaz became the great-grandfather of King David. Where did Boaz come from? What was his lineage? If we look in his descent, genealogy, are we going to find something pure? Not at all. It says like this. You can see this yourself in Chumash and all the commentaries. Very briefly, I'll tell you the story. It says that there was a man called Yehuda that was a son of Yaakov Avinu, the leader of the tribes, who had 3 sons, Er, Onan, and Shelah. So he gave a son, Er and Onan, 2 older sons, he gave one in marriage to a woman called Tamar, very, very great woman of prophetic insight, very, very supreme greatness. And it says that he performed a certain sin with her. Again, I'm not prepared to go into the details, but he performed a certain intimate sin with her, and because of that he died. And he died without children because of that sin. So it says that because of that, there was a mitzvah of Yibum. Yibum, as I'm sure you know, is a situation when a man dies without children. We don't do it today for certain reasons. We do an alternative. But the mitzvah itself is that when a man dies without children, his surviving brother, you have to be very careful. First of all, let's just say it doesn't apply today at all. But the conditions are that if a man dies without children, his surviving brother must marry his widow, so that they can have a child in the name of the brother who is no longer alive. Actually, in the mystical writings, it says that it will be a reincarnation of the husband who died. It's another story for another time. The point is that when the son died, Yehuda gave the next son to Tamar to fulfill the mitzvah of Yibum. But he did the same sin with her, and therefore he also died without any children. But Yehuda didn't know that. Yehuda thought that these 2 men had died because there was something about Tamar that had killed him. He thought there was something about her as a woman that has an effect on husbands. There is such a thing. The Gemara does talk about such a thing. That this was a negative force that she was emanating, and therefore he refused to give the 3rd son for fear of his life to Tamar, because the mitzvah demanded that the next closest relative should marry Tamar. So what happened? He told her that Shelah was too young, and she should wait in her father's house as a widow, dressed as a widow, until he would be old enough to be given to her in marriage. So Tamar was a woman of tremendous greatness, and that's all she wanted. The mitzvah, she wanted to bring out of these men, this family. She knew who she was dealing with. She knew who the family of Yaakov was, and who Yehuda was. She knew that out of them would come a messianic seed, or seed of greatness. And therefore she waited for a long time until Shelah would be given to her in marriage. Of course he never was. And when she saw that he was old enough to be given to her, to be given to him in marriage, and he wasn't, so she dressed like a prostitute. She covered herself, disguised herself, like a harlot, it says. And she went and sat b'fesach einayim, at the opening of the eyes, which means a crossroads. And when Yehuda walked past, himself, not the son, when Yehuda himself walked past, she was present. Now, don't ask me how Yehuda got involved with a woman. That has to be discussed halachically. Also, the Mefarshim who say that it was not the sin. You think it is, it was like a man walking through the marketplace, takes an apple. I'm not going to go into the details of that. Let's just leave it as a mystery right now, because that's the theme that we're working on this evening. The point is that he passed by that crossroads, and he saw this woman, and it says that Yehuda, for him to engage himself in such a relationship was actually beneath him. It was not fitting. There was an element of negative. Understand, there was something wrong about that relationship. What exactly it was is not what we would understand today, but there was something wrong with that relationship. Why did he succumb? What happened? Why did he succumb to the temptation of such a relationship? So the Mephoshim explained that actually he had no free choice. Her attraction was so great. He sensed an attraction to this woman that was so great it was beyond human capacity to withstand such an attraction. The next time you get into a situation that seems too great to withstand, you're wrong about it. It happened already, and it doesn't apply to us anymore. Be clear about that. But it says right in that situation, Hashem sent a certain emanation that surrounded her as an aura that he was unable to resist. Actually, the way it says in Chazal is that he smelt Gan Eden. As he walked past this woman, it says, there are a lot of women you walk past these days that walk. Okay. There is a noticeable perfume, which by the way shouldn't be. I want you to know that it's part of sneers that a woman shouldn't wear perfume so strong that all heads in the vicinity turn when she sweeps through. It's not something a person, a woman shouldn't do. I'm not saying you have to smell like a healthy migrant labourer, but anyway, I admit we're getting sidetracked. The point is this, that she exuded an aroma that the Chazal say was of Gan Eden. She actually smelt, he smelt, and again, I wish we had the time to go into it. It doesn't mean smell with the nose. Smell is always an appreciation of a life force. That's why you breathe with the nose, which is the breath of life. That's why you smell with it. It appreciates why fresh things that are alive smell very good, and things that are dying don't smell good. Again, that didn't take a million years to just happen accidentally. Life force is always described. That's why it says the Mashiach will smell Yiras Hashem. He will smell who has fear of Hashem. It doesn't mean with his nose. But I'm not going to go into it. It's another story for another mystical night. The point is that she exuded this aura, and he was unable to resist, and he had a relationship with her, and that's what happened. Now, the important thing is this. She said to him, what will you pay me? So he said, they agreed on a price. The price was a young kid, a young animal from the flock. But he didn't carry those around with him, you understand? So he decided to give her a deposit, what do you call it? A surety, a deposit, collateral. So he gave her his staff and his ring, so she took those things off, personal things of his, and he went his way. She was pregnant. And she went back to dressing like a widow and sitting in her father's house. And 3 months later, when it was apparent that she was pregnant, people told Yehuda that Zinsa Kalascha, your daughter-in-law, has been a harlot. She has been acted immorally. She's pregnant. And you know she's as a widow and forbidden to get married. So Yehuda said, take her out and burn her. Right? The punishment, the Torah punishment is Sreifa, for such a thing, for that kind of immorality, is to be burnt alive. Actually, I'm not going to go into the Mephoshim, say it doesn't actually mean that. It was in a generation when such was not the punishment. It doesn't mean it literally. But just let's take a simple meaning of the words right now. He paskened on her death sentence. He was the judge. He was the judge, the leader of the Jewish people, the judge of his generation. He considered the matter. The facts were found to be true. And he paskened the death sentence on her. What did Tamar do? Of course, all she had to do was prove to him that he was the man. Huh? All she had to tell him was that, before you have me taken out and burnt, I want you to know that you're the person. And she had to just prove it because she had his private, she had his things that nobody else could have possibly had. But she, you have to understand this, she was afraid that it might embarrass him. And she decided that it was worth being burnt alive rather than to embarrass somebody publicly, to understand the greatness of these people. That's halacha, by the way. Just to know. So what did she do? She sent him the things privately, secretly. She, you understand, she could have saved her life by challenging him publicly and bringing out his private objects in such a way that she would have saved her life for sure. But he would have been embarrassed. So she sent them privately, and she said, the man to whom these belong is the man by whom I'm pregnant. So Yehuda had the choice, you follow what she did, she gave him the choice of receiving them in private and covering it up, not saying anything and letting her be killed, knowing that she'd never reveal the secret, or to own up and admit it was he. And of course Yehuda was of such greatness, and that's why his name Yehuda means the one who admits. Haidah means to admit, and that's why he was fit to be the king of the Jewish people, because he was a man whose ego was under his control, which is what the Mashiach will be. He said that she's more righteous than I am, and she was saved. And then it says, well, what happened the two of them afterwards, but the point is that she had a child. Now, that's a very, very, very strange story. If you were making up a saga of the pure line of how the Mashiach comes, you wouldn't have done it that way. What happened? The child was born. Twins. One of them was born, supposed to be the other one first. He had a son, Peretz, he had a son, etc. We had a son who was Boaz. Zerach. Boaz had a son who was Peretz, who had a son who was Yishai, who had a son who was David. But now, not so fast. That descendant of this strange union, Boaz, married Ruth. Two people with problems. Boaz having come from a relationship, which you have to put, I hope everybody's clear, that if you think about these stories very carefully, you'll see that they seem to be very impure on the outside, but inside, actually, they're beautiful and pure. When Yehuda had a relationship with Tamar, on the outside, it looks terrible. But on the inside, it was a mitzvah of Yibum. That means he was a close relative. And the mitzvah of Yibum is to marry the one who is the next closest relative. So actually, what was happening was not only kosher, it was a mitzvah. But to the outside, to the eyes of the world, to look at the external, it was a terrible act of immorality and prostitution. They have to understand that. So what happened? There was a man called Winnet. It's late and I'm not going to go into the details. Just one or two more aspects of it and then we'll try and leave it at that. Boaz was a man who married Ruth, right? Both of them from these strange backgrounds, in the following way. You know all the story? You all know the story of Ruth and Boaz? No. Very briefly, without going into all the beauty and depth of it, on Shavuos, we read the book of Ruth in a few weeks' time, Nitzashim. We'll read the book of Ruth. It's worth studying it from now until then, I can assure you. With the commentaries, read Ma'am Lais, read the ones that give you the depth of it in English, because it's one of the most inspiring stories you could ever hope to come across. What happened was basically, briefly this. Ruth was a woman who lost her husband. Again, same idea of Yibum, which is the story of reincarnation. So the seed of Mashiach being reincarnated through history. She lost her husband for a certain reason, and she came to convert to Judaism, to take on the Jewish halachic debate. Where she was converted before, when she married him, she was converted. Anyway, she came to take on Judaism. She had a sister of equal greatness who failed at the last moment, Orpah, and went back and didn't take on the challenge. But Ruth took on the challenge and she became Jewish, even though it cost her everything. Even though it cost her everything. She was a princess in Moab. She's from the royal house of Moab. She had everything that the world had to offer. And it says she's so coveted, she so craved Jewish spirituality that she came and left her people and she came as a pauper, poverty-stricken young woman to stay with her mother-in-law Naomi. She came into Israel to be a Gay Tzedek, a righteous convert. It says she was so poor, the Midrash, the Chazal even say, it says she came on the road, the Beit Lechem road. On the road of Beit Lechem. So the commentaries say, I think it's Rashi over there, says, what do you mean she came on the road? Of course she came on the road. Why do we need that information? He says, no, really on the road. She had no shoes. She had no shoes even. She was so poor. She was reduced to picking up sheaves of corn, ears of corn in the fields that were left for the poor people. And anyway, that's what happened. And that's all for ideals. Only for the ideals of what it meant to be a part of the Torah nation. As she was picking up sheaves, ears of corn in the field, like a pauper, Boaz spotted her. Boaz was the leader of his generation. He was the head of the Sanhedrin, the greatest man alive in his generation, a man of towering spiritual stature. He didn't go around noticing girls picking up corn in the fields. But it says in Mephoshim that what he noticed was her modesty. She didn't bend down like other women. There's different ways for a woman to bend down to pick up something. Some ways are more modest than others. Ruth stood out in the fact that she was so modest, she was careful about even the positions of her body that would look modest. There was a girl who came from the most immodest of nations. A nation that was started by incestuous immodesty and specialized in immodesty. So bad that we weren't even allowed to let them convert. She developed this purity. Wonderful, wonderful story, especially for women to understand. We'll understand it, maybe talk about it more in Shavuos. Says wonderful things about Ruth, and perhaps we'll discuss that in a few weeks' time. It's a shame if we still like to be together. Yeah. She took on that way of life as an ideal. When she entered the Jewish people in that way, she knew she had a mitzvah of Yibum. And the closest living relative, actually there was another relative who was closer, but he rejected her. She wanted to marry her closest relative to bring down, again, the neshama that she knew she had to bring down from the husband who had no longer life. The closest relative was a man who was so fearful of the negativity of a woman who had converted in from a nation who wasn't allowed to convert, because there was a big halakhic debate in that generation whether people from Moab weren't allowed to convert in general or only the men. The halakhic authorities were divided on the issue. One opinion was that no Moabite was allowed to convert into Judaism. And one opinion was it was only men, but women not. The truth was that women were allowed to convert in. But there were those who were so skeptical about it and so doubtful about its halakhic validity that they didn't want to have anything to do with such people. And this man rejected. Imagine that. He rejected the chance to marry yet a woman, the most amazing woman alive, who wanted to marry him and was carrying within her the seed of Mashiach. And he halakhically misjudged. And the Megillah doesn't even name him because of that. It calls him so-and-so. It calls him Ploni Almoni, which means so-and-so, so-and-so, such-and-such. Right? Because he didn't merit to bring his name into Torah, because he blotted his name out of Torah. And so she went for the next closest relative, who was Boaz, the greatest man of his generation. What happened? She had to tell Boaz that she wanted to marry him. But a man like that didn't need more than a hint, didn't have to spell it out for him, so she went down to where he was sleeping. He was sleeping alone at his threshing floor, it says. She went down, she laid down next to him, and she took off his shoe, which I'm not going to go into now. Maybe by Shavuos time in Yisrael we'll discuss the mystical symbolism, what it means. But he understood that that meant the mitzvah of Yibum. Why is a mystery? You can think about it until then. And therefore here he was. He didn't marry her on the spot. It says he showed tremendous self-control. He didn't marry her on the spot, even though it was very close to the end of his life, because he knew there was a closer relative. They first sorted out the fact of that relative, who then rejected her and so on. And he married her, and I think it says it was the last day of his life. That day, they were married, she was pregnant, she became pregnant, and the next day, if I'm not mistaken, it says Boaz died. Anyway, the point is, did you see what happened? Two people from problematic backgrounds, they both marry in a very problematic way, amid the glances, the very, very accusing glances of many people of that generation, and she becomes pregnant in such a way. One more, just let me leave you with one more detail, and then we'll have to leave it there for this evening. What happened to their offspring? What happened? Their offspring was a certain man who had a son called Yishai, who had a son called David. How was David born? And we'll just finish with this. You think David, the quintessential figure that carries the name of the Mashiach, not the anointed one, the Mashiach, you think his birth was any more pure? Most people don't know the story, by the way. You can read a very beautiful version of this in Kitov, which everybody should have a copy of that book. It's a three-volume book called Jewish Heritage. What's it called? Our Heritage. Book of Our Heritage. It's called The Book of Our Heritage. It's in three volumes in English. It's one of the most classic and beautifully written and translated books that you could ever hope to come across, translated by Rabbi Bullman, written by Kitov, whose daughter lives in Johannesburg, by the way. Can go and visit her. See that I'm telling you the truth. Anyway, the point is, you should have that book. There, he devotes a large section to the story of the birth of David. And you can check it up and see many more details over there. But very briefly, what happened was this. Listen carefully now. You're going to see the same pattern repeat itself, but in even just as sordid and complicated way. If this shir is later than you expected, I'm prepared to tell you the name of the person who asked the question, and then you can all hold it against that person. Another few minutes. Do you agree?
Yes.
David was born in the following way. His father, Yishai, was married to a woman. She was a very great woman. In fact, of greater spiritual insight than he was, as is always the case, I'm sorry to have to admit, that the woman in all of Torah lineage always had a greater spiritual insight than the husband. Unfortunately, that's the way it has been. But that's what happened. He was a tremendously great man. The fact that she was greater than he doesn't mean that he was in any way little. The Gemara says he was one of four men who lived who never ever sinned. There were only four people who ever lived who died only because of what Adam had done, but who never ever sinned themselves. And Yishai, the father of David, was one of them. So he was a man of towering spiritual might, who never sinned ever. And as I think I've mentioned to you before, the Gemara says that when he gave a shir in Torah, 10,000 people or 100,000 people used to come and hear his shir. So I'm very honored that you come and hear me. But no, he had 100,000 people who used to come and listen to his shir. Yishai was such a man. Now what happened was this. They had seven sons. They had seven sons. But before David was born, the old specter came to haunt them that his grandmother had been Ruth and her conversion was questionable. And there were those who challenged the legitimacy of all the sons. And Yishai was a man of such sensitivity that he became worried that maybe it's true, and he separated from his wife. He refused to have any more of a relationship with his wife because he didn't want children to be born into the world that had that stigma of a woman who had converted who maybe wasn't allowed to convert into Judaism. You hear the problem, how deep it went another generation later. She, of course, knew that it wasn't so. With her insight and her spiritual sensitivity, she knew that there was nothing wrong with the relationship, but she couldn't convince her husband. And therefore, what happened? What happened? Remarkable thing. Separated from him, she disguised herself as somebody else, married him. That means, you know, I won't go into how it was done technically and halachically. Unbeknown to him, he didn't know it was his wife. Not somebody whom he thought was somebody else. You should, if you've been thinking this evening, be thinking back all the way to Yaakov and Rachel and Leah. Is that right? Starts all the way back there, where Rachel is the one who's in the forefront, beloved, perfect, and actually it's Leah, who's the one who's always the one who's in the wrong situation, unloved, and it's out of her comes Yehuda, who comes the Mashiach. Goes all the way back there. The more you think about it, the more you'll see it's the pattern, the beauty of the whole pattern of Jewish history. At every turn, it's like this. I'll leave you to work that out for yourself. The point is that he thought it was someone else, and actually it was his wife. What happened? She became pregnant. What happened? David's mother, pregnant with David, was seen to be pregnant. And Yishai knew, or thought he knew, that he never had a relationship with her. So what happened? The child was born in the most intense stigma of debasement. Because when the child was born, everyone in the family thought that he was born from a woman who had been such a disappointment. She had promised, had the promise of being with the greatest woman alive. Right? Able to be a mother of someone like David. Married to a man who never sinned ever. And here she had become pregnant after being separated from her. I'm in a terrible, terrible shame. So what happened was, the child was so stigmatized. David was so stigmatized and so ostracized, he wasn't included as part of the family. He was sent out into the hills with the sheep. They sent him out to tend the flocks in the hills, and no one wanted anything to do with him. The brothers and the father, they wanted nothing, they wanted him just out of the way. For, as they thought, valid reason. Because he was such a spiritually negative individual. And David, alone out in the hills, was tending the flock, was tending Hashem's, ready, preparing to be the one who could tend Hashem's flock. He was tending the sheep in the hills, and he was learning how to become the king of Israel. Out there on his own, in nature, communing with nature, and unspoiled by anybody around him, he was learning how, learning the truth of the world. And he was learning it through the experience of being debased, of being ostracized and only being scorned, and people wouldn't speak to him. He learned how to control his personality and become a person who merited to become the king of Israel. What happened? How did it happen? Happened like this. When Saul gave up the right to become king and Hashem told Shmuel, Samuel the prophet, to anoint the next king of Israel, Hashem told Samuel, go to the house of Yishai in Bethlehem, and there you will find the Mashiach. One of the sons of Jesse, of Yishai, you'll find my Mashiach, king of Israel. So Samuel was filled with intensity at Hashem's command, and he went to the house of Yishai, and he walked into the house. Can you imagine? It wasn't a surprise to him at all to be told to go and look in the house of the greatest man on earth, who had never sinned ever, a teacher of Torah that few have ever come up to his standard. Made perfect sense to Shmuel. So he woke up in the morning after this prophetic revelation, and he went into Yishai's house, and he said to him, bring out your sons. I've come to anoint one of your sons as the king of Israel. So Yishai brought out his oldest son. Not obviously. And that son was as close to perfection as you can imagine. You can imagine that being born in a home like that, with a mother like that, and a father like Yishai, and every effort had been put into that boy, you can imagine he must have been a shining example of perfection. In fact, the Mephoshim say that he was so close to perfection that why did he not merit to be the Mashiach? Just to give you an idea. Do you know why he did not merit to actually be chosen to be the Mashiach? Because once in his life, he said a word that was slightly angry. When was it? And it was under pressure and provocation. When was it? We know when it was. When David, when he was on the battlefield, when this fine, amazing young man was at the head of the Jewish army. Do you remember they fought the Philistines in those days, the Plishtim. And who was the leader of the Plishtim? Goliath, who was a tank of a man, an invincible army in himself. Not, he was equal, exactly equal in greatness. Listen to this. He was equal in greatness to the messianic greatness. Why? interesting story. It's because he was born as the great-grandson of Orpah. Orpah was the woman who was the sister of Ruth. Ruth went on to greatness and she failed. And she went back to degradation in Moab. Terrible degradation. Terrible. Living with animals and terrible degradation. Out of her was born a grandson who was a giant of a man, but in the black side. And out of his sister Ruth was born a giant of a man, and of course they met each other in battle. And that's why David killed him. That's why I called him a dog, by the way. I'm not going to go into the details. You have to check it up yourself. Anyway, the point is this. The point is this. That on the battlefield was this man Goliath, who was taunting the Jews. And no one could stand up to him. The whole Jewish army couldn't stand up to him. So they sent David to the battlefront to take some provisions to his brothers. These are great young men who were standing there face to face with this giant on the battlefield. David, a young nobody, whom everyone scorned and would hardly speak to, was sent to be a messenger to take some little things to his brothers. So when he came up to his older, imagine the scene. He came up to his older brother on the battlefield. Across the valley, he's standing this giant of a terror of a man. David comes up to his older brother and says, I brought you some small things from home. What's going on here? So his brother says to him, he sees the situation, what they're facing. And nobody can stand up to this man, the whole Jewish. So David says, let me try. Let me try. So the brother says to him, a little bit angrily, go home. We don't know what the words were exactly, but he said to him something, which he blamed. And do you blame him? Here's this nobody who doesn't have any physical prowess. He didn't know that David had killed a lion and a bear single-handed out in the fields to save his sheep. He didn't know that. He thought that he didn't have any spiritual merit. He knew that you don't win battles. Hashem's battles, you don't win because you're brawny. You win Hashem's battles because you have spiritual power. But David didn't have any spiritual power. He was born in spiritual contamination. So of course he wasn't. What was he going to do on the battlefield? So he said to him a little curtly, go on. Hashem said, because of that? You spoke like that? You lost a little bit of control over there? You just gave up your chance to be Mashiach. Amazing thing. I won't describe the rest of the scene on the battlefield. It's, you can look it up in Tanakh. Anyway, the point is, that's why. Anyway, let's go back to the scene. So Shmuel sees this young man, and this man looks definitely like he's fit to be the Mashiach. So Shmuel steps forward, and a little prophetic voice in him says he's not the one. So Shmuel says, a little bit surprised, he says to Yishai, bring your next son. So the second oldest son steps forward, and he must have been a shining example of physical and spiritual power. And a voice inside Shmuel said, no, he's not the one either. So he asked for the next. And after all the sons had been gone through, Hashem had not told Shmuel to anoint any of them as the king of Israel. So Shmuel was very perplexed. Hashem had told him that one of the sons of Yishai, of course David was nowhere to be seen. David was out in the hills. David wasn't even mentioned. He was tending the sheep. And all the boys in the house had been brought forward in front of Shmuel. And Shmuel knew that one of the sons of Yishai was to be anointed the king. And none of them had been, he had not been given the message prophetically. So he said to Yishai, have you got any other sons? So Yishai said, no. He said, are you sure? So they all looked at each other and said, well, of course, there's David, but you don't mean him. So Shmuel said, well, bring him in. So David was brought in, and a voice inside Shmuel said, he's the one. And David was anointed king of Israel. What do we have? We have a very, very remarkable story. We have a story of each generation that brings the seed of Mashiach into the world that looks very, very, very problematic. Actually, inside it was kosher and a mitzvah. She was his wife, it was Yishai's wife. But what it looked like on the outside was an act of the greatest immorality. Let's just finish with an attempt, very briefly, to answer the question, and that is, why is it that way? Why does it have to be that way? Very briefly, the answer is to be found in what we began with this evening. Since it has to be a flourishing of the unexpected, it has to be from the least, the place when a flower, the way and the place in which a flower flourishes, before I should even say that it happens from the dirt, the most beautiful flower grows from the lowliest earth in the most unexpected way, at the most unexpected time, after what looks like a disintegration. That's the way Mashiach has to be. Therefore, that's the way a flower is, that's the way Mashiach has to be. We can ask a little deeper why Hashem wants it that way. So why does the world have to be that way? Why does the world itself have to be built that way? That the Mashiach has to come about in such a thing? Sometimes those questions are not valid. In this case, we can ask such a question. And there we have the following amazing idea, which I'll leave you to think about. And that's what the mystical commentaries say, something along these lines. The light of the Mashiach is the most powerful light in the world. His light is the light of the greatest purity. It's such a powerful light that it will redeem the world. It will be so bright and so pure that the worst people on earth will have confidence in him. You know that? It says when the Mashiach arrives, people will have such confidence in him. There's one great thinker, one great rabbinic thinker of this generation who actually explains it in modern day terms. He says that he actually goes so far as to say this. I was amazed to hear it. Rav Miller from Gateshead. He says that the final ordeal will be that there will be so much armament, so much arms, such powerfully destructive arms poised against each other in the world, that the problem will be that nobody will be prepared to use the arms, nobody will want to, but no one will trust each other to disarm. And the function of the Mashiach for the non-Jewish nations will be that it will be somebody they can trust, so that they can both disarm, trusting that each other is doing the job. They can destroy their weapons, because there will be somebody you can rely on. Each other you certainly can't rely on. But the Mashiach will be a figure so great, in such purity, that they'll have his confidence, he'll have their confidence, and they'll be able to do a remarkable thing. Be that as it may, the Mashiach will be such a powerful light that he will bring the world to its perfection. And the mystical writings say that where the light is strong, the darkest forces wish to suckle from that light. Wherever you have a high power, so the evil forces, they want to connect to that power. The evil forces are not concerned with people who are smashed spiritually. People who are living in the gutter and have nothing to offer spiritually, the evil forces can get nothing out of them. Those are not people who have any energy to feed to the evil forces. And therefore the evil forces, the negative drive, the black side of the spiritual world, always tries to connect itself to the voltage that's in the world of Kedusha, of purity, because that's the only real world. If you think about it, evil doesn't really exist. It's just a blind to give us work to do. It's only the world of purity and sanctity and Kedusha that really exists. And therefore the evil forces know that if they want to survive, they must be connected to the truth. They must be connected to the light of Emes. It's a long discussion, but that's what it is. And therefore they seek out the greatest and the best. That's why the most spiritual individuals, the people with the greatest and most noble personalities, are the ones who are plagued by the most difficult ordeals in life and the greatest temptations. And sometimes when you see a great man fall, it's not because he's weak, it's because he's great. And because he's so great that the greatest negativity has attached itself to him. The evil forces want somebody who has a lot of power. That's what they want. And that's why it says that the Jewish people are subject to the greatest temptation and they fall to the greatest degradation, much worse than anybody else. Because the spiritual negativity in the world wants us. It doesn't want anybody else. It wants the people who could be very great. It wants to bring us down, not other people. It pays very little attention to others. It has them where it wants them. But us, it would like to bring down. And the greatest among us are most subject to this force of negativity. And therefore, it says in mystical sources, Hashem hides the light of Mashiach in the places where the evil forces would least think of looking. The last place that the world of impurity, that the forces of evil are going to look, the last place that those forces will ever look, is in the places on earth that are already subject to his rule. He wishes to suckle from the places where purity is and he can feel the power. But the things that he already has control over in his own domain, that he knows there's no energy over there. How come he's such a fool? How come he's such a fool? How come he has such power in the world and he knows so little about himself? That's the nature of evil. He is called Melech Zakeh Nuxil, a fool, a king who is old and a fool. He's a king because he rules you. He's old because he's wise. He knows how to rule you, but he's a fool. He doesn't know himself. You can fob him off with a simple trick. If you know how to beat your own negativity, actually, a simple trick will take care of him, if you know how. And therefore, he can be fooled in this way. Hashem hides the light of the Mashiach in the dark pathways and back alleys of history in such a way that it escapes the claws of the negativity in the world and therefore enables to see the Mashiach to survive.